Have you ever wanted to interview somebody famous? John Humphreys has interviewed a few over the years, interrogating hopeful contestants on Mastermind on BBC Two, and uncooperative politicians and others on the Today programme on Radio Four. People don't generally get the better of John Humphreys, but one person who did was the Queen. Of those I've never interviewed, he says, the Queen would be my first choice. I once went to one of the lunches she has at Buckingham Palace, and it was there that I asked her. She said, no. So I had another little go. I told her that things were much more open now and that she was more than capable. And with a small smile, she said, no. And what's more, Mr. Humphreys, if I were to do it with anyone, it probably wouldn't be with you. Then there was Margaret Thatcher. Some of us are old enough to remember Mrs. T. Humphreys admits to having been very scared of her in the early days in the role. He interviewed her at the end of the 1987 general election campaign and thought it would be a smart move to begin by asking her what she thought was the essence of Christianity. Without the slightest hesitation, she replied, choice, which threw him completely. He says that for the rest of the interview, he never really recovered. If she'd said love or charity, he'd have been able to have a go at her, but he was completely thrown by her actual answer, which was choice. It's an important question, though, that he asked. What is the essence of Christianity? People have all sorts of answers, often contradictory, many of them way off target. Conduct a survey, for instance, among university students these days, and you will find that very few of them have any idea at all. I wonder what your answer would be. What is the essence of Christianity? Well, it would be very hard to find a better or a more succinct reply than the one that's appeared on your screen, and that we heard at the very end of that reading a few moments ago. At the beginning of the gospel record, John the Baptist sees Jesus coming towards him and says, look, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world. And it's as clear and as precise an answer as you could find, because Christian faith is about Jesus, very simply. It's about the utterly unique person that he was and is, and it's about the lasting significance for you, for me, and for the world of his coming and of his crucifixion and his death. He is the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world. Trouble is, though, that sort of language is alien to most people today. Today we don't talk much about sin or about lambs, come to that, unless we have roast dinner on the mind. And this kind of language is all a bit strange. It's all a bit far removed from where we are in 2018. It seems to belong to a bygone era. But then you see, those words were spoken by a Jew, and a forceful one at that, Jesus' great forerunner, John the Baptist. He was, like his contemporaries, the product of a very particular culture. Of course, it's very different from our own. Jewish thinking, Jewish assumptions, Jewish practice had been formed over many centuries by everything that is set down in what we today know as the Old Testament, the first and largest part of the Bible, the Christian scriptures. And over those centuries, the people of Israel became deeply persuaded of a number of things. For one thing, they learnt not only that God was there, but that there was no other like him, no other but him. The God of Israel was and is a holy God. And that should be good news for you and me, because we live in a world where compromise and cheating is the order of the day. But something inside us tells us that that's not the way it's supposed to be. We want justice and fairness and goodness. And the God of the Bible is that kind of God. He is absolutely good and right in everything he does. He couldn't be less like the mythological gods of Greek mythology, all of whom should really be serving long prison sentences given the way they behave. So it should be good news that God is a holy God, and yet at the same time there is something in us that makes for a barrier between us and him. For some reason, this is not the God we want. We have a way of preferring other gods or other things which make fewer demands on us than this one. And maybe that is why there is such enthusiasm today for mindfulness. Mindfulness is a kind of Buddhism light, really. It's totally non-prescriptive. It makes no demands. It passes no judgments. It's perfectly suited, in other words, to our busy and individualistic and secular Western mindset. And mindfulness invites me simply to step back into enhanced experience of this present moment, resulting, I suppose, in a somewhat calmer version of myself, but still at the center of the world I see. But I wasn't designed to be at the center of God's world. And my ongoing desire, maybe my determination to stay right there, is what the Bible means by sin. Sin is a relational word before it's a behavioral one. It's more about, it's less about breaking the rules and more about not wanting him to be the ruler. And there is, therefore, now a barrier between ourselves and God. So over the centuries, Israel grasped these two simple things, that God is there and he is good, and we are here and we are not good, and there is a barrier between us and our Maker. But the third thing Israel learned very deeply is that it is a barrier which we ourselves are unable to remove or to do anything really about. To the extent that we're aware of it at all, our natural assumption, our default position, is that it's up to us to break through it, or at least to make the attempt. And further, that if God is on the other side of the barrier, that he will be pleased with whatever efforts we may have made. Perhaps he will even compromise a little and meet us halfway. But those assumptions are wrong. It's not up to us. And in fact, it is beyond us to remove this barrier, which is where the religious systems of the world invariably go wrong. And it's why Mrs. Thatcher was wrong to say that the essence of Christianity is choice, because that puts me and what I choose and what I do at the center of the picture. Whereas if the barrier is to be removed, it must be at God's initiative and on his terms. We can't keep hurrying back and forth like Theresa May to Brussels in hope of a better deal. And that is why in and through all the Old Testament days, God provided for his people an elaborate sacrificial system at the center of the national life. Again, it's very different from our culture, but it was absolutely central to theirs. And it involved, among other things, the annual sacrifice of a lamb. And not any old lamb. It had to be a perfect specimen without blemish or fault of any kind. And it was a reminder that the ongoing sin of the people had to be paid for by this means that God himself had instituted and provided. And so in Jerusalem, day by day, week by week, year by year, sacrifices were offered century after century. It was a kind of visual aid to the problem. And as such, it was superb. But it couldn't really do anything about it. And it went on for century after century. And then one day, John the Baptist sees Jesus coming towards him and says, "Look, the Lamb of God, the real one, the one who takes away the sin of the world." I wonder whether you've ever taken a long, hard look at Jesus, or maybe you haven't done it for a long time. Lee Mack, the comedian, is someone who hasn't taken a long, hard look of that kind, but would like to. Seems to be too busy at the moment, but he would like to. And when interviewed on Desert Island Discs, this is what he said about the island on which he was told that he was about to be cast away. Seemed quite perky about the prospect, and this is what he said. "I'm glad you get the Bible on the island, because I would read the Bible. I think it's quite odd that people like myself in their 40s are quite happy to dismiss the Bible, but they've never read it. So, if an alien came down, and you were the only person they met, and said, they said, 'What's life about? What's Earth about? Tell us everything,' and you said, 'Well, there's a book here that purports to tell you everything.' Some people believe it to be true, and some people don't. And the alien says, 'Wow, all right, what's it like?' And you say, 'Well, I don't know. I've never read it.' 'Well,' says Lee Mack, 'that'd be an odd thing, wouldn't it? So, at the very least, yeah, I'd read it.'" So if we do as John the Baptist says and look carefully at this Jesus, what is it that we see. Here is how one person put it. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He worked in a carpentry shop until he was 30, and then for 3 years he was an itinerant preacher. When the tide of popular opinion turned against him, his friends ran away. He was turned over to his enemies. He was tried and convicted. He was nailed to a cross and strung up between two thieves. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never owned a home. He never went to college. He never traveled more than 200 miles from the place where he was born. He never did any of the things that usually accompany greatness. Yet all the armies that ever marched and all the governments that ever sat and all the kings that ever reigned have not affected the course of human history as has that one solitary life. And the reason for that is that God's irresistible purpose is to repair the damage that we have caused in his world. And the evidence of that damage, of course, is all around us. At the end of 2018, we were praying about some of it just now. From the recent horrors of Aleppo, through the present griefs in Yemen, all the way down to the everyday strains of business and personal relationships. We know all about relational damage. And that repair, that restoration, that removal of the barrier between us and our Maker, which lies at the heart of every other relational damage, comes through Jesus and only through Jesus. And though it's free to us, it came at great cost to him, because he is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. In Southeast Asia, in the closing months of World War II, a Christian woman named Darlene Dibler-Rose had been interned along with 1,000 others in a gruesome labor camp run by the Japanese. And she lived with these other folk in conditions that were frankly indescribable at times. Towards the end of the war, raids by Allied bombers became more frequent. When the air raid warning was given, the women would drop everything and run for a network of shallow trenches, which were the only hope of survival amongst the exploding bombs. But when they got there, they weren't always alone in the trenches. Dogs, wild dogs, mad with rabies, also sought refuge in a trench. And of course, one bite from a rabid dog was enough to cause a horrible and a lingering death. And one night when the air raid sounded, a young woman called Tors Hurgoveen took refuge with others in a nearby trench. They became aware of the approach of a dog, and they tried to ward it off with sticks, but it wouldn't go away. And realizing that the dog was rabid, that many people would die a horrible death if it got into the trench, Mrs. Hurgoveen wrestled the animal to the ground, and she held it there until another girl was able to kill it with a knife. And as Mrs. Hurgoveen attacked the animal with her bare hands, she was bitten and scratched repeatedly. Serum was sent for, but proved ineffective. And when she realized that this was the case, she knew she had to be isolated, and she asked for this to be done. The door of the hut was closed, and the key was turned in the lock. And when the inevitable end came, says someone else who was there, each of us who was present died a little. We knew that, fully aware of the implications, she had given her life that others might not die. And Jesus, John looks at Jesus, the one who came to give his life for us, and says, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. I began just now by referring to John Humphreys and his various requests for interviews. Judging by the experience of others at the time, he wouldn't have got very far with John the Baptist. What we're told in that reading is that emissaries are sent from Jerusalem to find out who he is and what he's doing. And the Baptist's answers are less than helpful. They're all negative. He keeps on telling them what he isn't. I'm not the Messiah. So, are you Elijah? No. Are you the prophet? No. Come on then, tell us something about who you are. Well, I'm a voice. That's all. Preparing the way and pointing to him. I'm not what you need, he says. The one you need is Jesus. And if that very great man could say, I am not what you need, then if we're honest, all other perspectives on life should say the same. Atheism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, moral endeavor maybe, or liberal humanism, or just classic prepackaged British niceness. None of these are what we need. What we need is Jesus. And wonderfully, Jesus is the one we can have. Look, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world.